Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Punk Rock NBA Podcast.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock NBA Podcast. Today's guest is a very good one, Matt Saincombe from The Hard Times. You've probably seen The Hard Times articles shared a million times on your Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, everywhere else, because that's what people do with The Hard Times. They share the articles. These guys are incredibly good at creating those kind of like viral shareable headlines. But more than that, there's actually a real business behind that site. And Matt is one of the people, one of the co-founders actually, responsible for putting that together. So that's what we talk about in this episode. A look kind of behind the scenes of The Hard Times, how they went from being just a little side hustle that him and his partner Bill started with $800 to actually getting a successful exit. They sold it for $1 million, I think, about a year ago. We get into all of that, as well as some tips for anybody else who is interested in getting into like media or publishing or wants to start a company. It might sound like that's not very punk, but as we talk about in this episode, it actually is pretty punk. But before we get into it, I wanted to mention a couple ways that you can support the show if you are so inclined. Number one, you can share it on social media. That really helps a lot. Just tag us, tag the guest. Number two, we have some new merch, which you can check out if you want. There's a link to that in the show notes. And number three, if you really, really, really like us, you can support us on Patreon. It is because of the support of the patrons that we're able to do the show at all. That's how we're able to pay Deanna, the producer and editor, who is amazing and makes the whole thing happen, as well as the software and other stuff that we use to make the show. So thank you very much for your support. There's a link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out. And with that out of the way, let's get into the episode. Matt, welcome to the podcast. I guess just to start with, let's get right into it. I heard that you are a liar and a scumbag.
That's not true, but the truth is far, far worse. I wish the only thing that I was a liar and a scumbag. The truth is I'm also a cheat, a scoundrel, a no good scallywag. I've taken out $47,000 in loans in my girlfriend's name while she was asleep. It's really rough over here. So I'm glad that you reached out because no one else will have me on their podcast.
Well, in all seriousness, though, as I was preparing for this, I was looking at your Twitter and it seems like you do weirdly get accused of being a lot of bad things.
Maybe I am those bad things. Maybe it's, you know, maybe I just don't like looking in the mirror. Recently on Twitter, I had 800 furries in my replies.
Wow.
I had angered a nest of furries? I don't know. What do you call a bunch of furries in a group?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think running a satire website is a little bit like every day you start off and you think, you know this because your history. Every day you start off and you go, you know, which oddly specific niche or activist group on the internet am I going to inflame today? Sometimes I get emails from people. I don't even know what they're referencing. They're just like, as a member of the victims of train wrecks, I want to just say that you're...
I find it incredibly insensitive. Yeah. You're like, Jesus.
My whole family died in a plane crash, sir. I don't...
Clearly, my intent with that Fugazi joke was to mock the death of your family.
You know, one time Ian McKay actually reached out to me because of a Fugazi joke. Or I reached out to him trying to convince him to come on my podcast. And he's like, your website is a pain in my ass. Because... apparently, he gets these emails from weird European guys who are just like, is it true? Are you getting back together? I heard something about the tickets because we did some headline about them refunding people's tickets.
Ian, why have you begun to smoke marijuana?
Exactly. Yeah. He actually forwarded me some of the emails and I was laughing my ass off. So it's like maybe like, you know, once a month or so, Ian McKay gets an email of someone questioning something that they read on The Hard Times.
Well, my advice, I mean, especially with GDPR, you know, this might just make your life easier in a few different ways. So just block all European IPs.
Yeah, man, that GDPR stuff is weird.
Until they can pass a test indicating that they have a sense of humor, which 99.9% of Europe would not be able to pass.
I love I love the enforcement of those sorts of things. There's just like a bunch of people, a bunch of government officials in a room, like write down like, thou shalt not collect data on any website in the world. Right. And then it's like, what are they going to, they're going to come chase me down.
My favorite part of GDPR. So for anybody who's listening to this, doesn't know what it is. GDPR, I think it's general data privacy regulation or something. It's a European law that essentially dictates how you can and cannot use and collect data, but it's very vague. So no matter how hard you wanted to implement this this law, it's extremely difficult to know whether you've done it or not. And one of my favorite things about it is, so it requires that you give people an option to delete their data. And one of my favorite things is if someone reaches out to you and asks if you have deleted their data, you can't answer that question. Because in order to answer that question, you would have to have their data or know that you have had their data.
Yeah, it's weird too, because there's even stuff where it's like, did you delete the data related to me asking you to delete the data?
Right, exactly, exactly.
You know, I mean, data protection is important, but it's really interesting becoming a small business person and watching some of the laws that my friends advocate for. And I'm like, really, how do you expect a small business to handle some of these requests? And what almost always ends up happening is the small business just like Googles, like, how do I handle GDPR? And then there's some plugin that's like $50 a month. And I guess that's good enough. You know,
that's what we do. I have no idea whether that would actually protect us, you know, if it was litigated, but
you don't have to be the fastest swimmer if there's a shark in the water, right? You just have to not be the slowest. So when a lot of these laws get passed, when you're a small business person, you go, okay, well, what would get the regulator just to say, it looks like they're trying, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, I put it in my privacy policy, you know?
Speaking of which, when did you realize, so I remember when you started the hard times,
mm-hmm.
when did you realize that this was, you know, a quote unquote real business?
You know, I don't think it became a real business for at least a year and a half or 2 years into the project. I was hopeful that there would be a market for it, but I wasn't sure. And within the first month or two, it became very clear that millions of people were interested in reading this sort of stuff.
How did you know that millions of people were interested?
They were on the site. Within the first month, we had millions of people.
Wow.
And I, you know, so I could feel the organic viral nature of it. It was at a time when Facebook would really let anything fly as far as organic reach.
So this is around like 2014 or something like that?
Late 2014, yeah. I would log on to my Facebook in the morning and it would, the top 9 posts would be friends of mine from around the world that I had met through touring, sharing hard times articles, like that hard times article that day. We would have 20,000 people like our Facebook page and we'd have organic reach on a single post of 1 million people, 2 million people.
Those were the days for publishers, right?
Yeah. It was like they had invented this amazing technology where if an idea was a positive one that friends wanted to share, it could really go around the world very quickly. And so we had millions of people on our website, but we didn't yet have the skills to understand how to monetize those views. And we also didn't quite have the skills to understand how to scale up our business to capture all of that energy.
What do you mean by scaling? Like, what would some of those things be?
I mean, we put out one article a day for probably 2 years.
And across all your properties now, you must have dozens a day.
You know, I think we're still at maybe between 7 to 9. Some days a little more if there's some breaking news. I still am a believer in quality over quantity when it comes to organic reach comedy. I think that if you can have an ace hit out there, that's going to be better than 5 things that people kind of chuckle at. So I still push for that. But thinking back about when we launched this thing and it became immensely popular very quickly, if I had the skills I had today, I could have made a lot of money in that time, but I didn't.
So were you not monetized at all then, or where were you at?
I had a general belief that within the first year, I thought that we shouldn't really have ads because I thought that our core thing that we were building was our brand. And I thought that we could maybe increase our brand name, cement our reputation, and I thought we could sell directly to advertisers, fans and such. And I would meet with those sort of people every once in a while at various different events, like maybe like the Alternative Press Music Awards or something. And they would say they're a fan of my site. And I had this general belief that the brand that we were building was going to be valuable enough that we were going to get some of this old school direct ad sale business. But looking back on it, you know, even once we decided to start putting ads on the site, I didn't 100% know how to build an ad business. So I started dealing with not the best ad partners, and some of the best ad partners wouldn't even talk to us.
Can you talk about the difference for anybody who's not familiar with, like, when you say direct ad buys versus, you know, ad networks? Can you explain that?
imagine you've got a publication and you've got a million eyeballs each month. The old school way of doing that advertising business is someone from Macy's gets on the phone with you and they say, we want to run a banner ad or a centerfold ad if it's a print paper. And we're going to give you X amount of money for this amount of impressions or this amount of runtime. So let's say $20,000 for the month. And that's our banner ad. And it goes to Macy's.com and it advertises this sale that we have, right? And we're doing this because we think that your brand, your readers are going to be our customers. That is like a direct ad sale. Programmatic ad sales is you put a line of code on your website and bidding starts to happen on the space. And there's a marketplace of tens of thousands of advertisers all bidding for general ad space among certain demographics. And pretty much what ends up happening is Macy runs an ad on your website, but they pay 10 cents instead of a dollar. And, you know, they compete against all these other people. So Vans, I would meet them at the APMAs. And they would run ads on my site all the time, but I never got them to do the direct ad sale business because why would they? They would just go through Google or any one of the various ad partners that we had on the site at the time. So I had this belief that I was building up a valuable brand to the point where I was going to get significant direct ad sale business. And then during the time, there was also another business that was being formed, you know, like my friend from Brooklyn Vegan had, which was you build up a valuable brand and then you outsource your ad department to like Town Square or someone else who pays you a guaranteed sum of money each month and then handles your ad business through direct ad sales and programmatic ad, a combination. I ended up mostly doing all this stuff myself. I cut a couple ad deals. I worked with Vice. I worked with Consequence of Sound. I worked with the Metal Injection guys for a little while. I just pieced it all together, but I never really went all in with any one particular person because I could never quite get the deal that I was hoping for. I feel like we kind of came in at the end of the party there a little bit, hard times. We were kind of like, hey, we've got millions of eyeballs on our website at a time where people are like, you know what's not valuable? Millions of eyeballs on a website.
Text.
Yeah. So me and my co-founder, Bill, we would joke around and be like, man, if we started this thing in the 90s, we would be like at the Playboy Mansion right now. But it'd be like called the Hard Times Mansion. Instead, we still have day jobs.
And so how long did the day jobs last?
I think I had mine for 2 years. I think Bill had his for three, something like that.
That's pretty cool that you're able to quit your day jobs after 2 or 3 years with a scene comedy blog.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a huge thing. I think I maybe pulled the trigger a little bit too soon on my quitting of my job. I actually got an email from Vice. They were doing our part of our ads at the time, and they sent me an estimate saying that they could estimate they were going to make $8,000 a month selling ads on our website. That was going to be my cut. They were going to sell $16,000 or $20,000 worth of ads, and I was going to get $8,000
net. You're like, sweet, I'm rich.
I said, cool. You know, and I walked down the hall and I said, I've been thinking about this for a little while, got to go. They knew that I was running Hard Times. It was more popular than a lot of the stuff I was doing at this SF Weekly. And then, you know, a month rolled by, that $8,000 never came in. 2 months rolled by, $8,000 never came in. And almost no money ever came in. And I was eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches thinking, why did I quit that job, that cushy music writing job? But eventually we pulled it together and we built a business. I like to tell people, you know, in the media world, I learned about the media business by falling into almost every pothole that you could along the way. Mm-hmm. So I used to be a writer, then I was an editor, then I was a publisher, and I just made pretty much every mistake that you can make in all those different positions. And then eventually that's how we figured it out. So when I think back, that was my learning process. That's fine. But I also go, damn, if I had the skills and connections I had now, back then, it'd be a different story. I could make a bunch of money.
It'd be like an 80s teen movie where, you know, 30-year-old Matt gets to go back and be in ninth grade again.
Yeah, but I guess, I don't know. You got to learn some way or another.
Yeah. One particular question I have about the Hard Times is the nature of your content is such that it can be shared without actually clicking on or reading it.
Uh-huh. It mostly is, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's kind of an interesting thing is that it's like super viral, but you don't really capture any, well, you guys capture some value, but like you don't capture a lot of the value if something gets 10,000 shares.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
Very painfully is how I think about that. Yeah. No, this is a central problem of running a website that's focused on headlines.
And being so good at writing. I mean, you guys are fucking great at writing headlines.
Thanks. Yeah, we have a great team. It's mostly not me anymore. The way I think about it is you dominate a niche, and then from that niche, that's like your base, and you can launch attacks out from that base. So we sort of dominated this subcultural headline niche, and people started to understand our brand, understand our logo. They would see it all the time. Their friends would send it to them. From there, you start to do things like articles, which the main joke isn't 100% in the headline. Like, here's 10 things so-and-so said to us while he was whatever. You know, there's like a joke where you want to dig a little deeper.
And because they laughed at 20 of your headlines, they're like, well, it's probably worth clicking on this because their headlines are funny.
There's a little bit of trust there. Another thing that we did is that a lot of satire sites actually believe so strongly, they lean into the trend, and they actually will sometimes put out headlines where it's just a headline and a photo. We decided very early on that every single one of our articles was going to have a body to it, which I know doesn't sound like a revolutionary thought, but it was a little different than many people who are in the satire game, including a lot of people who just like put the headlines up on Twitter and stuff. And our goal was that every time you click one of our headlines, there is a significant laugh in there that would reward you. So it's almost like the people who are prone to clicking, they say, you know what? These guys treated me well last time. Yeah. That last line, that big kicker, it was worth it. I'm going to give them another shot with this click. And then we use that niche that we dominated to expand out into like podcasts. We have the Hard Times podcast, launch a bunch of different verticals like Hard Drive, our video game vertical. You do mailing list, you do live events, you do merchandise. You bring some of the content directly to the social media platforms. You put up a video that is hosted directly on the platforms. This may be sponsored by someone. Instead of having to pull people off the platforms, you monetize just on the platforms. You do a whole bunch of different stuff. But the truth is, you know, it's just the nature of the beast, and it's not that great of a nature. You would hope that people want to come to your site. We do have some future plans around that. I'm kind of thinking about ways we could turn our site into a little bit more of not just building an audience, but maybe building a community with some sort of community elements in it to have a little more to do with commenting, a little bit more to do with user-generated content. That's sort of the future idea of the site. I'm really fascinated by businesses that make a lot more money with 10,000 diehard fans than they do with 1 million kind of lackluster audience members. So you always just have to evolve or die. So we're always just evolving. But yeah, that's as soon as you get a couple million people reading your headlines, immediate problem is, fuck, what do we do now? Because they're not coming, you know, only 10,000 of them got to the bottom of the article.
It's a pretty good problem to have, though, all things considered.
Considering the fact that we started it with $800, it is a good problem to have, right?
Yeah.
So we stumbled into this thing, and then we had a massive opportunity, and we didn't fumble the opportunity, which is
good. There you go.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, you mentioned spinning up some of those new properties and verticals and, you know, pieces of the business and stuff. I wanted to ask about that because it feels like you guys expanded pretty quickly into a lot of different things, into quote unquote real content and, you know, the podcast. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but Hard Money, is that your...
Yeah.
That's your thing? So that's finance, news, jokes.
The natural transition from punk to Wall Street. I mean, Mark, right. How could you avoid it, right?
Man, you're laughing because it's so obvious to you how stupid that is. But I thought that there was way more of, I mean, that's the name of my channel. Like, I thought that there's way more of an overlap of that than there is. Like, I foolishly thought that there was, you know, a decent sized amount of people who are into this kind of music who also care about CAC LTV ratio, and there is not.
Yeah. I feel like you and I both got enamored with the core philosophy of this subculture, in my opinion, which is DIY.
Yeah.
Right. And when you take DIY to its logical extremes and you stay a part of the subculture and you grow up, it turns into just business, right? Yep. It turns into a punk grounded, punk rooted business. You become a business person. And so, you know, I started my journey, I guess, as an online poker player. I've always been fascinated with risk versus reward, return on investment, these sorts of things. What ended up happening is met a guy. His name is Enrique Abeta. A really interesting character, former hedge fund manager, grew up really rough. He's a really interesting life story if you want to Google him. Trailer parks, I think homeless for a while. He worked his way up, went to a great business school, got a job on Wall Street, became a hedge fund manager, managed a couple billion bucks, was very successful, decided he wanted to quit Wall Street and buy his favorite music magazine, which was Revolver. And then I guess he decided he wanted to scoop up Hard Times after that.
Wanted to buy his like tenth favorite,
I guess. Not quite, you know, it wasn't, let's just say he didn't leave Wall Street for Hard Times, right?
I got all the good ones, so let's get the Hard Times now.
He's a big metalhead, you know, tattooed up to his eyeballs.
So he's the guy that bought Revolver.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Through a company called Project M. And I met with him and I got to know him over the course of a couple months. And we are very different in many ways, but I do feel like we share a lot of the same DNA. And I felt that I could learn a lot from him. And I liked his vision for Hard Times. We talked about all my different concerns for months. He satisfied all of them. I think maybe I might be the only guy to sell a media business and no one got fired. Everyone just got health insurance and pay raises. So,
yeah, I mean, typically when you sell a media business, everyone's like, oh, fuck, I'm out of a job.
Right. So the opposite. Check out this fucking background, dude. Look at that. This is an old Hard Times, right? I just got to know him a lot. And to be honest, I'm a big believer in the idea that sometimes people come into your lives and you do deals with them, which are valuable, sure, but the little pieces of knowledge that they drop along the way, the little lessons that they can teach you, are actually probably worth more than the deals. And so I wanted to keep him close. And he pitched this idea to me about starting a financial satire site. And he brought in a couple of his buddies, and we're co-founders on that now. So not only did I sell a business to him, I also started a business with him. And so now he's one of my core business partners. Talk to him all the time. He's a great guy.
Well, there's quite a few things there that I wanted to kind of poke at. But the first one is, in spinning up all these new projects and verticals and all this stuff, what's worked and what hasn't? And, you know, do you have kind of a playbook now for when you want to do these things? Because the reason I ask is because, you know, a lot of creative people have a ton of ideas. And I think their tendency oftentimes is to spread themselves too thin mm-hmm. and take on too much. On the other hand, like you said, you know, you need to constantly adapt. And especially in media, you know, mm-hmm. if you get too comfortable in any one place, then that's probably a bad place to be. So how do you kind of think about that, like finding new opportunities versus spreading yourself too thin? And, you know, what have you learned from that?
You know, I think that you ever notice, like, on like Instagram, hustle porn, Twitter, or like entrepreneur.com, sort of, there's like all these quotes where like, an entrepreneur never gives up. He gets in there every day. He reads 15 books. I'm a really big fan. I don't know if I'm doing it right, so I don't know if I can give anyone advice, but I'm a really big fan of pulling the plug on things. So I like to take a lot of shots, and I like to give it my all. I like to optimize. I like to adapt. I like to study the data. I like to see where our mistakes are, really fall in love with just focusing on the mistakes, trying to fix them. And then if it doesn't work, after you've really tried to optimize it, you just pull the fucking plug.
This is kind of the poker mindset, right? Of asymmetric risk profiles.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's where I got started with is, you know, I'd play poker for 5 hours or whatever. Then I'd study my hand histories for 1 hour. And I'd say, look, I'm losing every single time I'm playing Jack 10 suited out of position. Like, I'm playing it like a fucking idiot, right? So when people talk about, like, how do you expand or how quickly should you expand? I always think about it like, can I take a shot at this for a low amount of resources, but put my best foot forward so, like, I feel like it's a real shot? And can I do it for 3 to 6 months and actually see if the business would take off? And that's usually what I'm trying to do. So I did start Hard Times with $800. And, you know, so I do think in like a, unfortunately, I think kind of like a small way, which is, I think, doesn't help when you do some of the larger entrepreneurial projects. But I think, look, what could we do with $5,000? You know, could we start a video game website with $5,000? And what would it look like? And what resources do we have that are not capital resources? What human resources do we have? What other social media pages do we have that can help boost this thing up? And we just take shots at stuff. So we've taken a couple shots and failed pretty miserably. We launched a conspiracy theory website, satire website. It's called Truth Bang. The tagline was the truth, but louder. And it had all these fake ads all over it for like bunkers and like solid gold American Eagles and stuff. And some of this content was so fucking funny to me. But it was insane. So no one would ever share it because it's like...
Well, and now they wouldn't be able to.
Now they wouldn't be able to. Yeah, even if it did work, it, yeah. I didn't even think about that. But man, it fucking plopped. I couldn't get a single person to read this website. We did it for a little longer than we should have. I think we did it for like 4 months or something.
This is still not very long though.
I just got the group around and I said, look, this is a complete disaster. And they said, yeah we know. You know, we were wondering when you were going to tell us to stop. And so we had to pull the plug on that one. I tried to do a, with my brother Ed and my co-founder Bill, we tried to do one called Gut Check that was MMA and pro wrestling. Once Joe Rogan read one of our headlines aloud on his podcast and we still didn't see any traction, that's when I was like, okay, well, this is fucking done.
And this was satire also?
Yeah, it was like MMA satire and wrestling satire. I think maybe we had a little bit, we didn't have quite enough bandwidth, and I think maybe we weren't deep enough in the culture. I think that maybe if we were training jiu-jitsu or something, we probably would have be able to have some better reference points. We were just kind of fans of it.
I will say this as somebody who's been watching MMA and doing MMA and jiu-jitsu since the 90s. Those fans do not have a great humor detector.
Okay, so I think it was another, you know, pretty much all the jokes that... No, I don't want to say all the jokes. There's a large portion of that audience that their version of comedy is just like a picture of someone's beat up face after they lost and be like, "You stupid bitch." And I'm like,
right.
That guy just got in there and, yeah, and like fought the number one guy in the world. Like, we don't want to like shame the people who lose. Yeah. Like, we think they're warriors. And I think that maybe we couldn't find our footing. Maybe the audience wasn't there for it. And one thing led to another, and we had to pull the plug on that one too. I've done quite a few other things. You know, we've launched some podcasts that were flops. We tried to do a TV show that was a flop. We couldn't get that picked up. I think I fail all the time. Yeah.
This is an interesting point for anybody listening is, you know, that you don't have to sign up to doing this thing for the rest of your life. Like if you want to try something new, that's cool. You don't have to like say, this is going to be my life for the next 5 years.
Put your best foot forward. Make a little plan. Launch it in a presentable manner. Please don't launch something that's like hardtimes.wordpress.com. You know, launch it as it's supposed to look. Put in the $500, the $1,000, whatever it is, to your idea and present it to the world and see if you can gain some traction. I think it's a pretty incredible time right now in human history where so many things are so easy to create and launch. And I often look at some of my most talented friends and I wonder why it is they don't consider themselves small business owners and why it is they don't consider themselves like online content entrepreneurs.
Because rich guy bad.
Right. And it's really interesting because it's like, you know, they're always out there like hunting for jobs and stuff. And I always think about, look, get four people together. Get a visionary content person, get a business person, get a salesperson, and get a tech person. You can all have day jobs. You all chip in 1 to 2 hours a night after work. You don't need that much money. You need maybe $500, maybe $1,000. You get yourself some emails, a custom URL, whatever.
Probably not even that, really.
This is like if you want to pay someone $400 for a logo. You know, it's like you can launch a lot of ideas for incredibly cheap. Split up the equity, 25% a pop. You don't need to pay yourselves until there's extra money laying around. And you're off to the races. You're a business person. Get out there and get it. There's so many people that are so talented that I don't quite understand why they don't do that.
Well, it's odd to me that there's sort of this unspoken or sometimes spoken, but I think unspoken assumption that in order to make money, if you are making money, you have done something unethical and unsavory.
Right. Yeah.
And I just don't really understand that.
Or I even had people tell me like, well, I kind of hate money, which is like a crazy phrase, but my co-founder actually said that to me. Well, what was happening was I had a noted communist / socialist on my podcast, Brace Belden. He's a friend of mine from the punk scene who grew up, who went off and actually fought in these conflicts in the Middle East. Hmm. He started a great podcast called TrueAnon, but if you type in Brace Belden, you can read some stories about him. He went to go like volunteer as a fighter.
Seems like a stable fella.
he's one of the most charismatic, talented people I know, but it is definitely an insane thing to do.
Yeah.
And he was on my podcast and I was saying, man, you have the most amazing life story. You gotta sell a book. You have to write a book, you know? And he was really resistant to the idea and he was laughing at me. He's like, come on, man, I went over there to fight for a cause. I'm not just trying to milk it for my own benefit. And in that conversation, my co-founder Bill said, yeah, I think, you know, I'm the same way. I hate money in that respect. I hate the idea. And I think that there's something that happens where people, they never have any money and it's really hard not to have money. And then eventually you get like jaded and bitter about it to the point where you think that money is itself kind of evil or shameful thing to have.
Right. Like you've just associated the idea of money with unhappiness.
Right. When other people, including your friend group or your family group, don't have as much, it would be shameful to have it. And I think maybe I fell into that category too. And eventually the mentality switch that I made was I realized when I was a kid growing up in the punk scene, like I wouldn't wear any labels on anything. And I realized maybe now my number one morale, my number one like philosophy is that I want to take care of myself well enough that I can take care of the people around me that I care about.
Right. So like you were talking about before, and this is what I wanted to ask about, you know, you're giving people health insurance. Like I forget the tweet, but you talked about how you're able to kind of take care of people, and you wouldn't be able to do that without running a successful business.
Right. And so, you know, there's this whole thing where I think sometimes idealism clashes with responsibilities. And I've turned into a guy who's a little bit less idealistic and a little bit more loaded up with responsibilities. And I like having responsibilities. I got some employees and they've got kids and I care about them. I care about their kids. And, you know, I'm happy taking the blows too. It's like, yeah, you know what? I'm an evil entrepreneur. Whatever, man. But anyways, the end of my story is, you know, Brace, he told me, hey, man, that's not me, right? Now, Brace has created a business that I am so jealous of since. He created a podcast called TrueAnon. I'm a huge fan of this podcast because Brace is truly one of the most charismatic people in the world. Like, he just exudes jokes and confidence and charisma. He's got a Patreon. I think they make like $50,000 or $60,000 a month on their Patreon.
Oh, wow.
This is a business that has two hosts, one producer, a couple microphones.
Super high margin.
Right? These people are just fucking crushing it. Yeah. Right? This is like, I mean, that's maybe what he would have got on a book advance on my stupid idea.
Maybe.
And so I feel like there's this interesting thing happening out there where the only moral way to make money, according to the internet, is through a Patreon. I'm not sure what
right,
that is.
That's true.
I don't, you know.
OnlyFans, like, I don't, yeah. I'm confused as to how that's more righteous than anything else. But
every way of making money is evil, except a subscription exclusive content business. I don't know what that is. And I guess people think that if you sell an ad, you're beholden to your advertisers.
Which is true.
It's true if that's how you operate.
But by the way, you're beholden to Patreon. You're beholden to your audience too. I mean,
you ever see a content creator get captured by their audience? I've seen it. They know they cannot go too rough on Donald Trump, or they know they cannot go too rough on Bernie Sanders.
Absolutely. We all have a boss. You know, I remember I used to work for Abercrombie & Fitch, and, you know, the CEO was also the chairman of the board. And I remember somebody telling him, like, oh, well, that must be nice, Mike. You don't have a boss. And he kind of laughed and he was like, I have a million bosses. Everybody who shops at our stores.
Yeah. Yeah. You're forced into certain things. You know, one of the nice things about hard times was the programmatic ad revenue stuff that I was complaining about. It means you get less money, but it also means you don't know your advertisers and your advertisers don't know you, and no one fucking cares.
Because they're not going to call you and complain about some article because they don't even know their ad ran on your site. And they don't care.
So Vans will run $3,000 worth of stuff on my site, and we'll run an article about how Vans fall apart, and no one knows and no one cares. I'm trying to think of a single time we've never gotten a complaint from an advertiser. Sometimes we will be pitching certain advertisers and I'll say, hey, can you, for example, one time with a Warped Tour, I said, this is my big editorial. this is like my big corruption.
Your heavy handed editorial oversight.
We had a joke that was like, Warped Tour stages moved back 100 yards to comply with sex offender laws.
Right.
And I told the guys, I said, look, I'd really love to sell some ads to Warped Tour. Give me 3 or 6 months to see if I can pull that off. And if not, we'll let them have it. You know? Yeah. So look, I mean, we all are corrupted in our own ways, but I would think if Warped Tour was willing to chip in to help out our project and I could help pay my people more, I think that they would be happy with that.
Well, and, you know, and that's a little bit of a difference there because this is jokes, not journalism, and you don't have any moral obligation to, you know, tell this joke this week.
Roast some people.
Yeah, I think that probably helps too. But first, a quick word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello out there.
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hayden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to Nothing But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
And let's get back into it. You talked about equity a minute ago, and I saw that you tweeted about this, that you gave the editors a hard drive equity. Can you explain to people why you made that decision? And I guess just to break it down to basics, what is equity and why would you want to give that to your editors, and why would they want to get it?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So let's think you and I are creating a podcast together, me and Finn, and we don't have any money. Now, we both think this podcast is a good idea, and we're both going to spend a bunch of time doing it. One of the ways to guarantee that at the end of the day, when this thing actually takes off, we both share in the spoils, is we split the podcast company 50-50, right? And we both have some responsibilities. Maybe you're in charge of booking the guests. I'm in charge of trying to sell the ads or building the website, whatever it is. It gets a little more complicated when you build a site kind of early, and then later on you're adding employees or freelancers and you want to get them involved. So you can't quite do 50-50. That wouldn't quite be fair to yourself. My general rule of thumb is any editor... For a while, every editor at Hard Times had equity.
Meaning what? That they own a piece of the company?
They own a piece of the company. So if the company gets sold, they get paid out, which they did. And we took it a step further. The editors who didn't have equity, because there was some rotation where we had like a crew of editors, and then some of them left and new ones came on. So some of the ones that still didn't have any equity, we gave them a...
And they hadn't vested or something? Or
pretty much what ended up happening was... there were some people who had left with chunks of equity that I was a little unhappy with. I was like, oh, fuck, this person's gone. And they took
cap table drama.
Yeah. So I was kind of getting a little bit more stingy with it towards the end when we were bringing on new people. I was waiting around to see if they were going to stick around or build something really valuable for us. But what ended up happening is when we sold the company, we gave anyone who didn't have equity bonus checks as if they did.
I always think it's so fucked up. Like, I was reading this book about Instagram, and they had a similar sort of situation. So they sold for $1 billion, and fucking Kevin Systrom didn't give any of those people anything.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I was like, really? Not even... The dude made fucking hundreds of millions. He didn't even give the people like 50 grand?
That's very bizarre.
I do not understand how somebody could live with themselves. I'm going to see those people at work the next day, and you're like, yeah, man, you don't get anything. But yeah, the headlines about me making 500 million bucks, that's all true. And no, you don't get anything.
I couldn't quite do that. I feel like my general rule of thumb with equity is give people opportunities. And if they build something valuable, I think you're morally obligated to give them equity. Meaning, Hard Drive, our video game section, was an idea I had really early on when Hard Times started popping off. I was like, we should expand into video games, but I needed a group of people to help me with it. I eventually found it within our freelance pool, right? Now, those people actually were the ones who kind of took that idea, changed it, evolved it, created the voice, actually pushed it forward, actually did the work, right? And it took off. These people deserve to own a chunk of this company at this point. I mean, this is something where my rule of thumb is, look, if you give someone 5% of the company, but they grew the company by 6%, we're all coming out ahead. So I'm a big believer in giving people equity. I also feel like really early on in my life, I was the editor-in-chief of the yearbook, and my advisor put me in charge of like a lot of stuff. I was like in charge of budgets and stuff, like just crazy. Like I was just running the yearbook. And I asked her kind of why she was doing that. And she said, you know, people never work harder than when they have ownership over something. Mm-hmm. When it's theirs, they take care of it. If I told you you had to work this many hours and you know, then you would slack off. And I found that to be true. You tell someone, look, you're going to own 2% of this company because you created this podcast for us or this sub blog for us. And if we sell this thing because everything's going great, you're going to get a piece of the pie. You don't need to worry so much if that person's going to slack off. They're not going to.
Yep. And if they do, well, that's on them, I guess.
You know, especially because I think most of the people who work for us, I don't think that they've had equity in a company before, right? So it's like, right, it starts to become a little bit of like their nest egg. And I think that's an important mindset to give to people. I don't want many of my freelancers to stay freelancers, meaning like I don't even want them to freelance for my site very long, although it would be wonderful if they do. I want them to start their own projects. I want them to get full-time editor gigs places. I want everyone to use everything that we're doing as a platform and a stepping stone.
And that's all going to come back to you eventually. I know you're not doing it selfishly, but it will come back to you eventually because those people are going to go on to be important people at other companies who will end up collaborating with you in some way or another down the road. You're going to get a call from somebody that built the next Hard Times.
Right.
That's going to call you and say, hey, Matt, thank you for giving me a chance 9 years ago. Here's this thing going on now. I would love for you to be part of it.
Bill and I always joke, we network with our interns and we always be like, let us be a janitor one day because we always feel like kind of like that imposter syndrome. We're like, we're sure this is all going to blow up in our face eventually. So when one day you run a company, just please don't forget us.
I think of this the same way. And it's so strange to me that this is like a foreign way of thinking for a lot of people. Like I remember I worked at Office Max when I was like 18. And they would make us go in there at fucking 7 a.m. on a Sunday for like the store meeting and try to get us to sell more like credit card applications. And they're like, oh, you get 25 cents for each one. And it's like, I'm like, dude, I don't give a fuck about your credit card. I'm like, what do we got to hustle, guys. I'm like, dude, you pay me $6 an hour. I'm not going to fucking hustle for you.
There is no hustle, right?
Like you said, give people a piece of the action and they'll work.
Or even tell them this. This is what we do is like, check it out. Sometimes people come to me with this idea. They say, look, I want to create this podcast. I want to create this comic sketch or whatever, like this, you know, cartoon. I think if you put it on Hard Times, it would succeed, blah, blah, blah. I say, look, let's put it on Hard Times. Just make it. If this becomes at all a real thing that has, you know, you run it, you'll become a full-time employee. Go for it. If you can create value for me, let's fucking do it, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, the motivation is a weird thing. I mean, one of the main reasons why Hard Times exist is because I was a freelancer who would create some hit articles for places and they would all celebrate and they'd be like, congratulations, Matt, you did it. Our number one viewed article of the month. And I'd be like, cool, I got 30 bucks.
All right. Keep them coming, Matt.
Yeah, like who cares, right?
And I'm grateful for all the opportunities I've had like that. Don't get me wrong, but there is a point where you realize, man, I'm making other people rich. And that's cool. Like sometimes that's a great opportunity, but there's also a point at which you're playing yourself if you stick around.
I think you have to treat freelancing like a stepping stone so that one day when one of the editors who's a full-time person steps down, you're the obvious replacement. One thing we do at Hard Times is every year, it's kind of almost like a ceremonial thing. We take $800 and we give it to some freelancer with an idea and we tell them to go create the next Hard Times. And it's not something where we own any piece of this. It's just, we're just saying, look, we want all of you to think in a way where you can go do this yourself. I think that maybe in the past, maybe like when I was younger and not involved in this stuff, there's been this idea cemented that there's all these gatekeepers And like you need the guys from Hard Times to approve of your idea to make it or whatever. Or
like
you
when
need...
people send me their band or like, what do you think of it? I'm like, it doesn't matter what I think. I'm just one fucking person.
Yeah.
There's 7 billion other people on the planet who matter a lot more than I do.
Just go out there and fucking prove it. It's like none of it matters. It's like,
yeah.
So sometimes I just want all my people who are involved in this project to think of it as like, look, if you think that there's an opportunity to do your creative thing, I almost sometimes people pitch me things and they get weirded out by my response because I'll say, look, if this is a brilliant idea, why are you giving it to me?
Yeah.
Why would you not just keep this for yourself and become me? You know, it's a little weird, right?
And the answer could be because you have some expertise that I don't about this, that, or the other.
Maybe.
And I would like your help with that.
Yeah. Sometimes we do stuff like that.
Or the answer could be, that's a good question. I don't really need you.
Yeah. Which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you do this. I do this. I have a lot of people reach out to me and I just say, yeah, let's just hop on the phone. And probably twice a week, I have hour-long conversations with people all across the world. Trying to hone their ideas just because I'm like, yeah, man, good luck. It's like an open office hours.
I love doing that. I just can't. I wish I could because I really do enjoy that. I just literally can't do that and get my jobs done.
I have a little bit of a selfish thought about it, which is I do feel like some of the people who I talk to will create some great shit. And I feel like they might come back to me with some problem and the solution to the problem might be that they need 10 grand and I can give them the 10 grand and be involved in their business once they have it set up.
I've thought about this exact thing though, that if anything that I'm involved with ever fell apart and I needed to fill, you know, I needed another opportunity, I would do exactly this and just say, hey, let's talk about your ideas. And
yeah,
eventually something would come of that. You know, mm-hmm. here's a link to my calendar, book some time, let's talk. And something would come of that. You know, just like you tweeted about, you know, how you found Bill by just kind of putting yourself out there. You know,
yeah.
I think it's like kind of a stupidly simple thing. It's like, well, how do I find a co-founder? Well, did you ask?
Do you have co-founders in any of the stuff that you're doing?
Yes.
How did you find yours?
Well, one of them I met at Golden Gods with the Metal Injection guys.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I met through, long story, but you know, it's all goes back to that. Like anybody that I know, it's because I did something like that of putting myself out there and just sort of saying, hey, I'm doing this thing. If anyone thinks it's cool, let's talk.
Yeah.
That's how I know everybody that I've ever known. And it seems like it seems like people don't do that. And I understand that some people are afraid to put themselves out there. That makes sense to me. But the idea that it hasn't even occurred to people to just kind of ask is so strange to me.
Yeah. For those that don't know, I think you're referencing a tweet where it's a screen cap and it's me in 2014 being like, hey, I'm thinking about starting a punk satire website, kind of like The Onion, but for Vice kids or hardcore kids. And you don't need any writing experience, but does anyone want to help me with this? And then one of the comments is Bill Conway. He turns out to be my co-founder of Hard Times, just being like, I'm all in. You have my number. Let's get going, right?
Right.
And then I think maybe a day later, he sent me like 50 headlines, which were better than many of the ones that I was working with. And I was like, this is the fucking guy. Let's do it, Mr. Bill Conway.
Yeah. Well, I've told this story before, but one of the people who just completely changed the trajectory of my life is a guy named Chase Jarvis, who is the founder of Creative Live, who I worked for. Before that, he was a fairly well-known photographer. And the way that I met him is that I worked at this print shop and we printed something for this ad agency that he owned at the time and it got fucked up. And for whatever reason, they were like, hey, can you go talk to him and smooth it over? And I was like, all right. And so as we were waiting around for this thing to get fixed, I was just chatting with him and I hated that job. But you know, if you've ever done printing, it sucks. And afterwards, I was so miserable. I was just kind of like out of options. I was like, you know, I'm just going to fucking call the guy. So I called him and was like, hey, this is Finn from the print shop. Do you have a job for me? And he was like, man, I wish we did, but we can't afford it. But then I got fired / laid off a couple weeks later. And I called him and I was like, good news. I'm available for free. And he was like, all right, well, let's do it. And, you know, then from that, I ended up doing work for like Nike and Nintendo and Red Bull.
That's great.
And once you have a couple big names on your resume, then it's like off to the races. And then I worked for him again at Creative Live years later. And so point being is just, and there's other times I did stuff like that. And the person was like, yeah, this is weird, fuck off. But you roll the dice like that and eventually it's going to work.
That brings up a couple points that I always think about. One is I do feel like free work gets in overly bad name, because
yes.
I do feel like free work is a worthwhile pursuit if there's lessons to be learned or networking to be done. And if it's not, it can't be more than like 3 months or 6 months. Like you cannot.
By the way, they did end up paying me. They just didn't have any money up front.
I do feel like some people fall into like, I've been writing blogs for this website for free for 3 years.
It's like,
9 years. You have to stop right now. Like, send an email, please. Like, I'll stay on the phone while you type an email saying that you're going to stop doing that. And then another thing that comes around to that is I often feel like sometimes people go, oh, you know, how did you do this? And how did you do that? And I go, yeah, you know, I only had $800, blah, blah, blah. But I kind of forget to say, or I don't dive into the details that I was able to risk $800, which was like my last bit of money, because ultimately my parents would not let me starve and I didn't yet have very many responsibilities in my life. And so I had a safety net that let me try to be an entrepreneur. And I feel like that safety net is not universal and it's not always acknowledged. And I feel like a lot of times when people talk about their startup journey or their entrepreneur journey, they kind of fail to mention, oh, by the way, you know, my parents were paying for me to be a poet at college. And if I, you know, lost $3,000 printing up this poetry book, you know, I didn't have a kid to feed.
My mom would scold me, the end.
Yeah, the end, right? And so I definitely was one of those kids where it's like, it would have been embarrassing to have to ask my parents for food money and stuff, but they would have sent it.
Yeah.
One of the hardest things that people ask me about is they say, how do you get started with like nothing? You know, and that's actually the hardest question, because there's a lot of people who don't have the talent, don't have the skills, don't have the energy or whatever. And then there's other people who they have so many responsibilities already and so little capitalism or so little capital. I joke with my friends. I'm like, dude, capitalism is a really hard game to play if you have no capital.
Yeah, it is. But here's how you get around it is you do what I did, is you learn a skill and then you go network your ass off to find somebody that will pay you to do it.
Right.
And then you start accumulating some capital, which frees you up to do things. And it's hard, but that it is a proven thing. It works.
I also feel like something that's undervalued and gets too bad of a bad name is burning the candle on both ends.
Yes.
Meaning like, I feel like there is this whole world of entrepreneurship, which is, I think people refer to it as like side hustles, but it's like, keep your day job. I don't know if you've experienced this, but there's so many people who go, I've got this idea for a website, quitting my job next month. And I go, whoa, slow down. Slow down. Do you have an audience yet? Right?
Yeah.
Because you need an audience first, and then you need to monetize that audience. And you're 10 steps ahead of yourself. And then what they do is they quit their job. They go all in on this thing. They actually make some progress, but they don't make progress enough to live like a life of pure comfort.
Yeah. Gary Vaynerchuk talks about this a lot, I think, in really good ways. He's like, well, you got a 9-to-5. That's cool. What are you doing from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. every day?
I agree. Yeah.
You can get a lot fucking done, like you said earlier, if you just...
That was all of hard times.
Yeah. If you put in a solid 1 to 4 hours of work on something a day, you can get a lot done.
That's all hard times is built after my job at SF Weekly and during Bill's job at an electrical supply warehouse, where his bosses were actually okay with him. He was like a good salesman. And when the calls came in, he did his job. But they knew that he was writing articles on the side. And they said, hey, good luck. We're happy for you. You know, we hope your thing takes off. And just that little in-between time is where we made a difference in our own lives. Mm-hmm. You know? And is it healthy? Probably not, right? Because I would be working 18 hours, you know, whatever.
I don't think anybody would say that entrepreneurship is good for your physical or mental health.
Yeah, it's bad for you, right?
In the short term, at least. Yeah. Like, I don't think anybody would say that.
But once I got over that hump, I am a big advocate for burn the candle at both ends and understand that time and human capital can be your biggest resources. Partner up with someone who's willing to burn the candle at both ends too. Find something, give each other some equity, and build a business with fucking nothing. because then at the end of the day, you have something. That's how you go from nothing to something, right?
You make something.
Yeah.
So you're originally from the Bay Area, right?
Yeah.
How much of this do you think comes from growing up there in a place where entrepreneurship is so much a part of the DNA of like that part of the world?
I don't know, man. Sometimes I laugh about how California my lifestyle is.
Uh-huh.
Like just growing up going, look, I'm a punk kid who has a like three companies and a tech startup. So I'm like, this is like, I went, you know, I grew up going to shows at Gilman Street and, you know, I'm surrounded by news about all these businessmen doing their thing. I become a journalist. I have to start reporting on some of these guys. There was a meaningful time in my life, maybe 5-6 years ago, where I said, you know what? I am sick about reading and writing about all this money that is changing hands above my head. Mm-hmm. Like I'm at my house in the Bay Area and the money is like, oh, $10 million here, $20 million here.
And there's just fucking sickening amounts of money going around. You know, I live in Seattle, same thing. We live right between Microsoft and Amazon. Mm-hmm. Sickening amounts of money changing hands. And it's super influential to me to just know that that's happening around me and going, I just need a little fucking bite of that and I'm good.
Dude, the table scraps.
Yes.
I joke with my friends. I'm like, look, I don't need to be a hot shot.
No, I want to be the poor guy on the block, but I just want to be on the block.
The table scraps will go a long way. Yeah, I started a startup. We raised a little bit of money. We're raising more. I got my table scraps. It wasn't easy. I had to learn a lot. I got some books my advisor sent me right here.
This is Outvoice.
Yeah, it's one of Venture Deals. Be smarter than your lawyer and venture capitalist.
Who's that one by?
This one is by Brad Field and Jason.
Oh, okay. He's great.
And this one is, this is the one I mostly read, Secrets of Sand Hill Road by Scott Kupar.
Okay, I don't know that one.
This is the one. I got a advisor. His name is Deez. He sends me books in the mail.
Deez Nuts?
But yeah, man, I think that I'm pretty California. I just like to eat tacos and
sure
play in punk bands and start tech companies. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, last thing is, a lot of what we talked about as far as like equity and, you know, giving people opportunity and stuff falls under the heading of leadership, which is something that does not get discussed at all in our world. And I think that is a fucking tragedy because whether you are running a business or putting together shows or you're in a band or whatever, like leadership is a skill that everybody needs to have. And I think it's a shame that nobody ever, 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 ever talks about it in the scene. Is that something that you've put conscious effort into? What does that word mean to you?
Very good question. I feel like I'm learning more about being a leader all the time. I don't know if I'm excellent at it yet. I definitely feel like I believe in a snowball effect, where I believe that each positive step you make in your own life through the help of friends, family, advisors, etc., each positive step you take will make you bolder on your next step. And I think when you book a show successfully and a touring band comes to town and you let them crash at your place and you get them food and everyone gets paid out and they're happy, it's a good show, they tell you it's better than the last time they came here last year, you did a better job, they like the flyer, etc. I think that gives you a boost in your step, and then you feel like you can book a bigger show, you feel like you can book a tour, you feel like you can book your own band's tour, you can put out your own band's record. And I feel like eventually through that punk scene stuff, it's really not that far of a stretch to say I'm going to start my own company.
Not at all. Because you already did. If you booked a show or put out a record, you already did start your own company, whether you know it or not.
Yeah. And then it's not that far to say, okay, look, I started a company. I sold it for $1 million. Well, now I'm going to start a company. I'm going to sell it for like $500 million. It's actually, mm-hmm. it's actually not that far of a stretch.
Especially once you understand, oh, this is how a company, these are the mechanics of what would make a company worth $500 million. Do I have a credible shot at making something that looks like a company that's worth $500 million?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I could do that.
Okay, I don't know if you think about this. I think a lot about how anything that's been done before by someone likely can be done again by you.
Sure.
Maybe not everything. There's some hard skills out there. You know, there's some rocket scientists who are doing stuff, but there's so much that, you know, people aren't really that special. No one's really that unique.
Right.
I don't think I'm that unique of a guy. I think that just with each step, you get bolder and bolder and you start saying, how far can I push myself? And you get to that edge where you're pushing yourself far enough where you're making mistakes and you're failing. You have to be failing pretty often so that you can learn from each mistake, and that's how you're growing. And I think that the path from booking a punk show to successfully raising money for a startup company and selling into businesses and
it's the same thing.
Significant annual recurring revenue. It felt like the same thing to me.
It's the same thing. Instead of wearing like crust vests or wearing like Patagonia vests, but it's the same thing.
It feels like a logical step. Now, I don't think all my friends agree with me on that. But I believe that there's these steps that like are get demystified. So when you look at like some of the stuff that Black Flag did where they like demystified touring and you can go now read up about it. I think those books are very similar to these books over here that my tech company advisor was giving me about how to raise money. I think it's, look, people have done this shit before.
Yeah. And they will tell you exactly how to do it in excruciating detail. Like if you go to howtostartastartup.com, there's the fucking playbook.
So why should I sit at home and not be a part of it?
Yeah.
That's my MO is I'm saying, look, so everyone's out here improving their lives, but I don't get to because it's a little bit mystical because I'm not quite sure because I don't quite have the right connections. I can fix that.
If you choose to sit that out, that's a choice. You can't complain about that. You chose to sit it out.
Yeah. So I think you got to get out there, make a shit ton of mistakes, learn every day, and then eventually you'll get some victories. I've gotten a couple of victories, and I told one of my friends recently, I said, you know, when I go to eat out, I can get a Coke and I don't have to worry about the fact that it's $2 extra.
Dude, there was a time in my life where that was a real choice, a real decision that had to be considered.
That's super real. And, you know, I think when you've gone from that to a little bit above that, everything else is icing on the cake.
Absolutely.
That's what I realized about Enrique, the guy who bought Hard Times. He grew up so rough that he has this incredible ability to risk so much. And I think the reason is everything is icing on the cake to him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like just having a roof over his head is like that's the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
And I think that there's some power in that. I think the punk scene has some powerful philosophies in it. It also has some pretty dumb ones.
Yeah.
But I think that it's like a logical thing. That's why I've always been intrigued by what you're doing, because I do think that the punk rock scene, hardcore scene, I think it's a straight shot. It's like hardcore school right into entrepreneurship. And
absolutely.
You know Jack from Twitter was a security guard at Gilman Street.
Oh, so I knew that he went volunteer to shows, but I didn't know that he actually went to Gilman.
Yeah. There's like, you can find pictures of him. I went to Gilman and I asked some of the people because I heard that rumor. I said, is that true? They said, yeah. You can find little pictures of him with like, I think he had little globe spikes.
Yeah. I've seen that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm sure you're busy guys, so I want to respect your time. I'll let you go, but I appreciate this very much. Great conversation. Is there anything you wanted to add or plug before I let you go?
Well, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate the time. It's good to catch up. I appreciate what you're doing. I don't know what to plug. You know, my name is Matt Sankum. You can hit me up on Twitter if you want to talk about something interesting. If you run a publication and you want to handle your freelance content creators in a better way, automate away their invoicing, go to outvoice.com is one of my companies. If you like finance or stocks, go to hardmoney.net. If you like video games, Hard Drive. If you like punk music, probably most of this audience here, check out The Hard Times. And yeah, that's it. Thanks for having me, man.
Cool. All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.